So, it's good to be back. It's strange to be an external speaker. I thought that external speakers were a bit more glamorous than this, so I thought I would try and dress in my best external speaker outfit. I don't have a clicker, so I'm going to use Dougie, if that's all right. And can we go on to the next slide? So, when we left, which is almost exactly 6 months ago, someone said, well, if it doesn't work out, you can always come back. And as I was walking on this beach, 12 minutes from our house, watching the bottle green sea crash and foam, and the sandlings sort of scuttering for their breakfast along with the oyster catchers and the gulls, I thought, why did we leave? But enough about our sufferings. So I did want to say that I know that you've been praying. We left primarily for family reasons, and we were really conscious of God's timing, because just as we arrived, things started to unravel for Joyce's mum in particular, but we were able to be there and support, and things are now stable. So we do feel that God was very much in the timing. And I want to come back to other reflections from this speech. But I want to move on to the book, and I'm going to recap a little bit on the book, if I may. Next slide, please. I'm going to be quite visual today. I hope that's okay with you. But some have described the book as being divided into these two halves, the doctrine, the issues that need addressed in terms of thought, but then how do you live that out, the kind of so what. And so we're looking largely at the second part, and if we can move to the next slide. Another contextual thing about the Church of Colossae is it was a merged congregation of some from Jewish backgrounds, and these would have been the conservative types in the congregation who would have said that it's important that you obey not just the moral law, but the ceremonial law if you want to be close to God. And then the Greeks, who were more influenced by philosophers and said, well, you need to free your mind and be a bit more liberal, and you know, it's about what you think and getting close to God in terms of your thoughts. And next slide as well, please. The other contextual thing is that one of the thinkings that was emerging, and it was probably influenced by Greek thinking, was this kind of sense of a split perception of the world. So everything of the world was dirty and bad, but everything in the spiritual realm was a higher realm. And they had this kind of dichotomous split. And so they had this obsession with angels and folks who could bring you close to God, who went between the two. And there was a question about whether Jesus was just one of these intermediaries. And to some extent, some of this thinking from Greek thinking has still influenced us in our whole sacred-secular split. And, you know, we reward intellectual jobs better than we reward physical jobs. So there is still that sense in society that that's the split. But what Paul does, if I can have the next slide, is he kind of uses that motif to address the issue. But you kind of see this theme all the way through. And what he's saying is that there is a heavenly truth. This is the real reality that then should reflect our earthly behavior. And that Christ is not just an intermediary, kind of in-betweener, but actually he's the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning of all things, the Creator, but the Redeemer, as well as Lord and Sovereign. So that sense that all things are encompassed by Christ's sovereignty. So that's a theme that runs through Colossians, and I think is relevant for what we're going to talk about today. So I feel like Chris Whitty. Can I have the next slide, please? So, and obviously this is written on a scroll, not in chapters, and it's quite interesting that when you have a book in chapters, it makes a clear break and it starts afresh with each chapter, but a scroll tends to be a bit more continuous. So there's a kind of a flow to the thought, and there are these four areas that break up the passage. So the first is around the church community, and we've had a kind of continuum of that, and then living out Christ at home and at work, and then speaking for Christ, and then there's a kind of reflection on Christ's workers. And I'm going to change the order a wee bit, and I hope you're okay with that. There's kind of a bit of an elephant in the room with the second of these. I want to kind of jump into that, and then I'm going to come back to the first one. So can I move on to the next bit? I'm conscious I can't see Mima, but I know she's here. So I did do some homework, but I'm conscious that I'm outgunned today. So one thing that you need to understand for context in terms of Roman thinking was the Roman household was really key to Roman society, and that was the strength of the society was in the household, and within the household, the master, the father, the paterfamilias. I feel that Latin should be spoken with a Western Isles accent, because that's always how I've known it. But the father and the master of the house had the power of life and death over his children, his wife, and his slaves. That was the structure. I'm just checking in with Maima, that's correct. Yes, okay. And that was normal in society. So this is the context that's really important for what we're going to hear next. Next thing I'm going to ask is, has anyone here got either a Jamie Oliver, a Delia Smith, or a Mary Berry cookbook in their house? There we go. Okay, so that covers most of you. So for households in Roman times, there were actually people who wrote rules for households. And there are several of these that have been discovered. But the key difference, one of many key differences, is that they address the master of the house. There are no instructions for anyone else in the house. It's for the master of the house. This is how you manage your wife, your children, and your slaves, which is an important contextual difference. But a bit like that, if I had referenced Jamie Oliver, most of you would have known what it meant. But in society, there were social norms and expectations, and people would have understood that these rules existed. So can I move on to the next slide? Because that's the context, is that essentially Paul is speaking to a Romanized society and a Roman household structure that has the father of the house as the kind of controlling factor. And into that context, which has this subtext of power, next slide please, Paul is saying that is not how things are to be for you. So Christ is sovereign, so not a power dynamic, but a love dynamic is how your household is to be managed. So let's move on to the first of the people addressed. There was an older couple celebrating a 50th wedding anniversary. What's that? Is that golden? I know I should know this. Thank you. And they asked the couple how they'd managed to reach 50 years together. And the husband replied that it was fairly straightforward. After they got married, they sat down and they agreed that the wife would manage all of the small decisions in life and the husband would manage the big decisions in life. And he said, you know, in 50 years of marriage, there hasn't been a single big decision. So before I tackled this, I did what any sensible husband would do, and I asked my wife what I should say. So I am paraphrasing some of the things that Joyce kind of gave me, which I thought were really helpful. The first thing is, of course, we judge this passage with modern eyes. And so before we do that, she pointed out on a BBC website there was a survey of British social attitudes. Did anyone else see this just in the last week or so? So apparently 92% of couples believe that household tasks should be shared. 92%, which is interesting. But that's up from 50% in the 1980s. But when they surveyed further, 2/3 of women felt they were still doing far too much stuff around the house. Okay, and 1/3 of men admitted that they don't do enough, which means 2/3 of men actually hadn't noticed. So the women, yes, were more active in the workplace and were carving out careers, but were still carrying the majority of the work with the children, with the house, and probably looking after elderly parents. And I think what Joyce was meaning was, before we start to judge, we need to hold a mirror up to ourselves and say, well, are we quite as egalitarian as we like to think? And that's the context for us to think about. Now, to some degree, there are several problems with this particular part for some people and things that they may react to. And the word submit is one of those. And one of the reasons it's maybe difficult is because of the history of abuse and the abuse of power, which is exactly what Paul's trying to address. And I thought I could try and put up a slide with substitute words, put up with, suffer, persevere with, but actually, probably I would be going off topic. I did look at the Greek because I thought we need to kind of deal with this elephant, and I think a reasonable translation is support, but again, asking Joyce what she felt, she said that for her it would mean respect and listen. But I don't want us to get too drilled down into the words for reasons I want to try and explain through the whole of this passage. What I do want you to notice, though, is that Paul gives wives motives. And the motives he gives is to serve the Lord. And that's what's meant, fitting in the Lord, is what is pleasing to the Lord. It's one interpretation of that. So in other words, do this for me. Do this for me. But it's not a know your place woman. I don't think that's the sense here. So there's one sense to which wives are to love their husbands because they are, by doing that, loving the Lord. But it is also within limits, because another reading of that line, as is fitting in the Lord, suggests there are limits. And no woman should have to put up with abuse. So I think that there's a very clear limitation in that sense of who's sovereign on what's written there. But I want to keep the flow going, because I'm hoping this will make a bit more sense as we keep going. So we've covered a little bit of the instructions. I'll come back to this picture. But sticking with husbands this time round, you'll know that there's a parallel passage in Ephesians 5, and husbands get a bit longer of a talking to in that passage. But in that passage, Paul says, "Love your wife just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." The Colossians passage says that you're commanded to love your wives. And the two are very interesting. It's very clear, obviously, that we are being instructed as husbands to create an environment that nurtures and creates a loving environment for our wives. That means we need to avoid over-criticism or criticism in general, but impatience, temper, and other negative effects that we can have on our spouses. And I was really struck by that command to love, because obviously love is more than feelings, but it's not less than that. And you wouldn't ordinarily think that you can command love, but Paul is being very clear. Husbands are being commanded to love. And the reason I thought that the Ephesians passage was helpful was this idea of the husband giving himself up for his wife, or laying down his life for his wife. So I guess for those of us who are husbands in the church, we need to think about what do we need to lay down for our wives. For some of us, that might be the remote control or the phone occasionally, but it might be bigger than that. It might be ambitions, it might be pride, it might be selfishness, it might be laziness that we need to set aside. So there's a very clear direction to husbands there to love as Christ loved their wives. And I think that's really important in terms of the way it's framed. And I think that's a consistent pattern that I hope you'll see as we carry on. Can we move on to the next slide? And the next one again. I love this carving, by the way. You can see that the girls are being kind of well-behaved and something constructive, and the boys are knocking lumps out of each other. So things haven't changed. Children in this context would probably have been under the age of 12. So this is really quite young children that are being instructed. And I don't think many of us would have too many issues with how important it is to bring up children well. We've seen spoilt children, and there's something ugly about people who carry that through life, whose behaviors become hardened as they grow older. But I think what's important about the way that Paul's framed this instruction to children, directly to children, is probably captured really well in the message, which translates the verse, "Because this delights the master no end." So there's a sense in which children are being asked to obey because it makes God happy as their true father, and that's something that pleases his heart. So there's a motive there for children, because it's not taken for granted that they necessarily have good and kind fathers or Christian fathers who've listened to the next section. So there's an instruction there with a motivation for children. And I think kind of insinuated in that is a sense of the God who sees. I always find that Christmas song about Santa seeing when you're sleeping and when you're awake a bit creepy. And that's not the kind of creepy sense we meant here, but it's the God who notices. It's the God who notices the smallest. So even the smallest of his disciples are important to him. Shifting to parents, then, I asked for some help from my sons, and I asked the question, which I'm not sure if I should recommend this, but what exasperates you, and what advice can you give on what does this passage say? Scott was quiet, which may be telling. Fraser wrote the following, and I'm going to read this if that's okay, because I thought it was really helpful. "As kids grow, they remain under the charge of their parents, but they are needing to be able to express their independence while still under supervision. so that their independence is guided and mature when they move out and not like being set free. And he made the point that Jesus often talks about being a gardener, so children should not go wild or go to seed. They need trained, nourished, developed, and pruned, but not over-pruned, or they struggle to develop or grow at all. So we need to watch also the unintended cuts, the sort of sarcasm, indifference, unkindness, the small things that can somehow harm children's growth. But I'm conscious of time, so I'm going to move on to the next one, which is servants and masters. We've got our mistress here who can't decide what chocolate she wants from the chocolate box. Now, I think this passage is interesting for lots of reasons, which I'm hoping will be clear. One of the instructions to slaves, as it is to, I'm sorry that the text is quite small, but to serve not just when you're being watched, which I think is quite interesting. Implicit in that, a little bit like the children, is the sense that God sees you when they don't see you. But again, I don't think the intention is here as a kind of, I'm watching, but I think there's a nod to the Old Testament where it talks about God seeing the suffering of his people in Egypt. The sense of God understanding and seeing their perspective on life. And they're urged not to perform to win favors, but to do it for the Lord. And I don't know if you noticed this as we were going through, but some of the wording seemed a little unusual for me, that they were to serve with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Does that strike you as a little bit odd to talk about work, particularly as a slave? I was trying to think of what an analogy would be, but if you're folding bed sheets or you're cleaning your house, how do you do that with reverence for the Lord? If you are cleaning a toilet or teaching a class or doing work with someone, what does reverence and sincerity of heart look like? And I've started to think about this a little bit in my work. You know what I do for a living, but my work is temporary. And I thought, well, what gives it permanence is relationships and how people experience what I do for them. There's something about permanence in that. So perhaps the way in which I do things could be more than the act itself. There was a survey conducted of doctors that these helpful surveys suggest that people don't remember most of what we tell them, but they do remember the way we treat them. So it made me think, well, perhaps in the way I conduct my work, I can leave some more permanent effect. The other thing that I thought was a bit odd in here was the word inheritance. Did anyone else notice that? Who gets an inheritance? Time for audience participation. It's not a trick question, I promise. Children, yeah. So if you work for something, you get salary. That's the way it works. And if that was land or houses, it's still salary. But inheritance is for children. So I think the context here is that Paul's saying, you are Christ's children, you are God's children. So you don't need to work for favor, you already have favor. So come from that place of being given so much through Christ and serve out of choice and out of gratitude as a child and not as a slave. So it's a very different place to come from trying to win favor. And then he turns and addresses masters. He says, you must be right and fair because you are servants to me. And he's, in this passage, giving slaves and servants rights and, in some respect, putting masters in their place. So this time around, I think there is a bit of a sense of I see you. So there is a bit of a slightly more directive sense of God being aware of how masters treat his children and the slaves who he also sees. But I want to come on to the next slide. And after that, another one, I hope. Yes, so we started off talking about the context of power as the kind of behind-the-scenes implicit thing in a Roman household, and how Paul was wanting to address that slightly differently. But does it strike you as slightly odd that Paul, who was a bachelor, never married, never had children, and never had servants or slaves, is teaching households about marriage, children, and industrial relations? And I thought there's something about what Paul is trying to do here, which I think is subversive. So the subtext, as I say, of the Roman household was power, but what Paul is trying to implicitly say is the subtext of your new life needs to be that love dynamic of Jesus. And what is important, if you understand the context, is that he always addresses the powerless first. So if I can have the next slide. So he addresses the wife first before the husband, the child before the father, and the slave before the master. And that's quite significant in the way it was written, because they wouldn't have been addressed at all. And he gives them choice, and it may not feel like much of a choice that he's giving them in the context, but in a sense, it's the same choice that Jesus had, to love his father and show his love for his father in how he lived. He gives them motive from gratitude and love, and he gives them status. So they are no longer chattels or possessions, they are relationship. And their relationship is made significant by Christ and by their relationship with the Father. So it's quite a subversive thing. Can I have the next slide? He also, I think, not quite taking down a peg, but he addresses those with power. So he says to husbands, and I know I'm quoting the Ephesians one, lay down your life. To parents, get down to eye level. And to masters, you are my servants. So there is a redressing of the balance in that. But can I have the next slide? Some of you may feel that Paul isn't strong enough on slavery, because Roman slavery was potentially appalling. And why is he not stronger? Why is he not dismantling the whole system? And you can discuss that over lunch. But I want to say just a few brief comments, which I think are part of the story. Again, see Mima for details, but Roman slavery was quite a broad thing. So some Roman slaves were doctors and some were more menial tasks. So it had a breadth about slavery in the past, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't abuse. Secondly, the Old Testament did not condone the Roman picture of slavery, so it should have been abhorrent to a believing Jewish household. And thirdly, the 17th and 18th century slavery, which the UK played its part in, was some of the worst excesses of the slavery picture. So it is not the same picture, but I have heard people say that the church has been split on the issue of slavery, and some have appeared to condone it, so therefore, in modern contextual times, perhaps we're not able to speak into the context because of our past mistakes. And it's certainly true that the church is on the both sides of every issue, so the church in itself is not a guide. But I thought there's a lovely little subversive thing that Paul also does by talking about Onesimus. And you'll know his story probably. He was a slave to Philemon, so Philemon got a separate letter about him. He was a runaway, which meant he was, in theory, imprisonable. He came to faith, and he served with Paul, and served Paul, I suppose. And he was being sent, in this passage, by Paul with Tychicus together. And what he's saying is, when you're in church and this letter arrives, Onesimus will be up front with Tychicus just after the sharing of the bread and wine with the elders. He will be up front here in your church. And Paul is quite a referee to have. I've had some interesting referees in the past, but Paul's quite someone to have on your referee list, isn't he? And his reference for Onesimus is he is our faithful and dear brother, very important word, who is one of you. So, I think it's just a little disingenuous to say the church is definitely on both sides of everything, because I think if for those Bible-believing Christians who studied the Bible, Paul could not have allowed you to think it was okay to support the slave trade. And I think he permanently pulls the rug from under that. But I can let you discuss that over lunch later on, because I want to move on a little bit, if I may. And I think this is the bit that is another key message in this section of the text. I came across this quote that no part of existence remains untouched by the loving and liberating rule of Jesus. And I think that's the profound point. There is no bit too small, no disciple too young, no one too important or unimportant to matter to him. And therefore, everything we do matters to him. I love this translation from the Message, and in fact, the Colossians is worth reading in the Message because it's beautiful. But all the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe people and things, animals and atoms, get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, his blood that poured down from the cross. And it's that early part in Colossians 1 where it's describing the supremacy of Christ, but also his redeeming role, so that when we work together to turn noise into music or PA that works, or that we bring order out of chaos and tidiness, or we turn hurt into healing, or ignorance and confusion into clarity and knowledge, we are doing that redeeming work. We are changing and working as Christ would do to make life better and more Christ-like. But I've been challenged in our church. We have been looking at Jonah, and I wonder if I could come on to the next quote, but I've been really challenged by this quote from John Webster, and apologies, I'm going to have to read it. When our hearts become hard, we banish God from part of our lives, perhaps our work or our marriage or our attitude to our neighbors, or even perhaps from our Christian faith. We decide that we will allow God to go so far, but not all the way. And when our hearts become hard, then we cease to expect much from God. We allow ourselves to slip into cynicism, and the life of faith withers. And I've been very challenged by that, and perhaps there are parts of your life that you feel you need to talk to God about, whether it's marriage, whether the command to love applies to you, or whether you need to nourish and tend your family, or if your work situation is tough and you need to feel that God sees where you're at. And I wondered what the remedy was for a hard heart, and this is only tentative thought, but I wondered, given that it's a theme throughout Colossians, if thankfulness was part of it. Sometimes God needs to break the stone of our hearts and to chisel it, but I wonder if sometimes he needs to melt and dissolve it. And I wondered if that was the role of thankfulness, recognizing in what God had done, how he had changed our status, and the verdict that he had delivered over us. Maybe that needed to soften our hearts to his sovereignty. We're short of time, so I'm just going to move on, if I may, to the last two sections, just in summary. The next section in chapter 4, verses 2 to 6, on speaking to other people about Christ, I found really helpful. I struggled to share my faith. I found it intimidating and difficult. But I found it really helpful reading Paul's take on this, who was asking for prayer as a professional evangelist, you might say, asking for prayer for both opportunity and clarity. Week past Friday, I was caught up in the train strikes. They weren't due on the Friday, but they decided at 8 o'clock p.m. in Preston that the train to Lucas was going to stop in Preston. So they bundled us into taxis, and I shared a taxi with four strangers, including, I think, a girl in her early 20s from Shanghai who didn't know how to get across the UK. And I was fairly dehydrated. There'd been no drinks on the train for 6 hours. I was very grumpy. And I the fold-down seats in a taxi, I kind of decided after a little bit of chit-chat and politeness, I thought I would lie down on that and try and sleep. And in my head, I was thinking, no, you should be making conversation. There's a reason you're in this taxi with these people, these strangers. But I was very grumpy. Anyway, we had to change taxi at Edinburgh, and I took the student on a run up to to St. Andrews to drop her off before I went home. And at 2:30 in the morning, she turned to me and said, "Do you believe in God?" I thought, I really need clarity now. So the other thing that I thought reading this is that, and I love that expression, full of grace, seasoned with salt, because most of my conversation is full of salt, seasoned with grace, and I think I'm doing really well. But the message again translates this as bring out the best in everyone. And I think there's something about if our conversation allows people to feel safe, to feel able to open up, to talk about things, then you might more naturally get into the kind of conversations where things important are discussed. Faith is not an issue like the weather that you can sort of start off from the superficial level. So you need to create the kind of conversational environment that allows people to do that. I'm going to move on to the last section, which is all about Paul's very pastoral messages and the workers in God's family. And it's very striking if you look through it. There's a name check for a wealthy woman, there's a slave, there's a rehabilitated Christian worker and a successful secular worker, and there are Jews and Gentiles. And it's the full hodgepodge of God's family. And if I can come on to the last slide, I didn't realize when I put this in my slide deck, you know, I have the heavenly truth, the upper and lower. So there's quite a nice reflection going on there, I thought. Anyway, so coming back to the beach, we are very grateful for your continued fellowship with us. One of the things that I think really tells you about a church is when you leave it. And then you'll know that apart from family things, we've had to find a church, which we found and we're really pleased with. But we've been very grateful for your ongoing support and messages and prayers. And I was walking that beach and thinking of you. And I have one of these prayer lists. It's a bit mechanical, but it reminds me of to cover everything. And when it comes up to church topics, although we've been gone 6 months, I can't help coming back to praying for you and to thinking of you and giving thanks for you. And I'm going to have to start a new list for the new church because I haven't managed to shift focus. But I'm afraid it's just hardwired that we long to see you blessed, and are so delighted to hear your news and your progress. And I'm thankful for all that you are and all that you continue to be for us. So I want to finish before we sing, and I want to read as our benediction for you those verses from the beginning of the reading for today, if that's all right. So think of this as our prayer for you. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you are called to peace, and be thankful. Let the message of Christ dwell among you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom through psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit, singing to God with gratitude in your hearts. And whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. We're going to sing our next song. Has the refrain, yet not I, but through Christ in me, which I think Joyce taught us before we left. So let's stand and sing together. Joyce is saying we don't have time in true worship. Do we have time to sing, or do you want? Aline's saying yes. Okay.